Hi, my name's Teresa Cottam and I'm the Chief Analyst at Omnisperience. In this issue of our Podzine, I'm talking to Cerillion's Dominic Smith about business model innovation in telecoms, James Saunby from Inca about what the independent network sector is doing in response to the COVID crisis and rural network rollout, and Wi-Fi expert Ben Toner about Wi-Fi 6E. And then Georgina Elrington turns the tables on me somewhat and interviews me about the nano business sector. So we hope you enjoy this issue of our Podzine. And for more information or to download other copies of our Podzines or green papers, please visit our website at omnisperience.com. Hi Dominic and welcome to the Omniscene. Can you please begin by introducing yourself and Cerillion?
Thanks Teresa. Yes, I'm Dominic Smith. I'm the Marketing Director at Cerillion Technologies. We've been around for about 20 years now. We're a specialist provider of BSS and OSS solutions with a particular focus on service monetization and automation of the back office. We also provide a horizontal subscription management platform for digital monetization in other verticals as well.
So Cerillion has certainly been busy over the last few months, despite, you know, the current crisis that we now find ourselves in. Can you please give us a quick update on what's been happening?
Sure, yes. I mean, as you say, it's been a very busy time for Cerillion and very successful as well. In the last year, we've won 5 major new CSP clients all around the world. And so we've got clients come on board in the last year in the Americas, Europe, Asia, and also down in Southern Africa as well. And this for us is a real mix of, I guess, our traditional BSS transformation projects. Some of them are retail. We've also done some wholesale work, but we're also doing some best of breed deployment stuff as well. So one of the projects is just purely focused on convergent charging for an MVNE, a mobile virtual network enabler. Lots of success and projects that are in flight. We're also on the product side of things. We've actually just this month released Cerillion 8.1, and that comes with a bunch of new features around our mobile app, our enterprise product catalog, and also a fully revamped user interface, all geared towards, you know, increasing productivity and all helping towards the automation goal. So lots going on. It's been pretty full on, to be honest.
Right. So clearly COVID-19 is having a big impact on everyone's business. As the industry starts to look beyond the crisis, though, as to what happens next, what do you think the impact's going to be? And I'm particularly interested to hear what you think the impact's going to be on, for example, tariffs. Is there some scope for some innovation here? You know, we've got households and we've got businesses that are going to be under stress. Is it actually going to be a catalyst, do you think, for CSPs to think about the type of packages that they're offering?
I think absolutely. I think there's plenty of scope there for creativity and, you know, perhaps also in places more granularity in how services are sold rather than just big packages, more targeted offerings that are going to solve a particular problem either for a person in their home life or their home working life or for the way they operate their businesses as well. I think where we've got to with the coronavirus crisis, you know, has obviously affected all walks of life. But I think it's really taught people that if they actually get on and do something, it can be achieved. I mean, if you look at how quickly businesses have had to adapt and have adapted, you know, to transitioning to all staff working from home, you know, these are things that probably a lot of businesses have been saying, no, that's not possible. But actually, it is possible. They've just done it. That's something that they can look to take forward into how they actually launch new services and new products is not say, no, it can't be done. It can be done. Let's do it. And let's do it perhaps in a different way. You know, what we've seen with some of the services that are now sort of growing out there in this sort of remote working environment are probably some good examples that CSPs can learn from as well. You know, one example that really sticks in my mind is that of everyone's favorite video conferencing software, Zoom. And if you look at their pricing model, it's really quite interesting because I guess it's a variant of the freemium model. They have a very easily accessible service, which is free at a basic level. So if you just want to make one-to-one video calls, it's free, no limitations. If you want to make group calls of up to 40 or 45 minutes, I think it is, that's also free. But the moment you actually want to do a more business-oriented or a larger social gathering that's longer than 40 or 45 minutes, that's when you need to pay for your subscription. And then, of course, they have these sort of upsold add-ons as well for these sort of side rooms and, you know, extra packages that give you different options. But essentially, they're creating this sort of massive network of users. They've grown from, I think, is it something like 10 million users to, I know, 100 or 200 million users in a pretty short space of time. Of course, a lot of those are on free, but actually are now starting to take these services back into the office and say, I'm going to actually want to pay for that extra level of service here because I can use it in this way. And I think that, from a CSP perspective, is something that they really need to look at and say, there's a service where they've worked out what the value is for the customer and they've gauged that point where they can actually start to charge and start to charge a premium. And that's something that I think all CSPs can really learn from.
So I'm interested in this because I think, you know, years ago, we talked about the idea of the family plan. It was a big thing for a while and it kind of died away. It never really came to the level of fruition that we thought that it might do. But do you think, you know, given this refocus back on the household now, that there's an opportunity to maybe to create some more convergent plans, some plans where we are looking at groups of people rather than just the individual? What do you think the potential is there, Dominic?
Yeah, I think there is some good scope around that. Families and sort of communities beyond the family and how services can be converged for those groups. And I think this is around effectively how you share a service. And that's whether it's between multiple devices, so for the same user, but lots of different devices, or for multiple users on whatever devices they're actually using. And I think this sort of ties into that Zoom concept and with some other products I can think of where sometimes you have these services where there's a kind of a service owner who's the one who's administrating that service, and maybe they pay as the owner of the service, but then they have other consumers who connect into that service who, to all intents and purposes, get that for free. You know, another example, if you go back to how the whole PDF model worked originally, you know, you would have people paying to create PDFs, but anybody could read PDFs because Adobe distributed the reader for free. And I think some of these services can potentially work in the same way. You know, you have an owner who subscribes and pays for the service centrally, and then they have a number of users who can consume that. And whether that's a family, whether that's a small business, I think there's quite a lot of scope around that. The other thing that sticks in my mind is really more around how money and how credits can be transferred and shared between users. You know, these concepts of shared pools of credits, or being able to transfer credit from one family member or one business user to another within an overall pricing scheme. I think that's where there's also significant scope for more creativity.
And I hate to mention the infamous 5G and the burning towers in the UK. Do you see 5G introducing any new business model innovation in terms of how we bill or charge for things?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, 5G is, you know, a lot of people have pinned a lot of hopes and investments on 5G in terms of, you know, future revenues. I think, you know, a lot of that is expected to come in the enterprise market and industrial applications that, you know, might benefit from the greater bandwidth and lower latency on offer. Every time that's discussed, it seems to be in context of things like network slicing and these, you know, private networks for certain types of enterprises and specific use cases, and people being prepared to pay a premium for having those private networks. And I think that perhaps does have a little bit of legs, but I think realistically we're probably still 2-3, maybe more than that, years away from that side of things really coming to fruition. So at the moment, unfortunately, it is still a case of looking at the consumer market and how 5G is being positioned with the consumers. And for the most part, what I see is still essentially more of the same from 4G, which is people are selling big bundles of data. However, I suppose I was encouraged to see a little bit more creativity from Vodafone, who followed a slightly different path. They've packaged up different offerings based on speed rather than on bundles of data. So they have a sort of entry level speed at, you know, 2 megabits. They have a medium level plan at 10 megabits. And then they have the top level plan, which is the so-called fastest possible. Unfortunately, they've slapped the big 5G badge on the fastest plan. And I think that's still playing to an audience of consumers who have been somewhat brainwashed into thinking they have to have 5G. But as you've mentioned, you know, the negative publicity around 5G and the burning of the towers might result in a bit of a rethink in how some of these 5G plans are actually positioned in the future.
And let's be very clear here, Dominic. People that have got a fully functional billing system and rating engine, there's a lot of flexibility there. There's a lot of capability in the technology. So it's not the lack of functionality that's holding people back from innovating new plans. It's usually, shall we say, a lack of creativity to actually think differently. And I mean, that's what we would be encouraging them to do, yes?
Yes. And, you know, I think that people who have implemented newer converged charging systems in the last few years should have those capabilities at their fingertips. I think there are still quite a lot of CSPs out there who have, for one reason or another, got a mixture of legacy systems and maybe don't have a single point of charging. And without the single point of charging, that does give you more complications in how you can package up these services. So I think that's probably one area where further investment is needed. If they're, you know, not having a single convergent charging engine, then I think that would be fairly high up their priorities list to put one in place to give them this flexibility moving forward.
So Dominic, as we start to look forward to the future, what are we going to see from Cerillion in the second half of 2020 and beyond that even?
I think I need to put this in context of where we've come from over the last couple of years, because over the last 2 years, we've really accelerated how quickly we bring new features and capabilities to our product set to market. We now have a 6-monthly product release cycle, and that we push out to our customers on what we call our Evergreen Software Program. So they get access to these new features much more quickly than in a traditional BSS, OSS environment of the past. We've only just rolled out Cerillion 8.1, but Cerillion 8.2 will be coming in October. So there's some great new stuff going into that. We've also, from a sort of customer's perspective, we've also got a bunch of go lives that are coming up, you know, over the next few months for in-flight projects. And of course, there's some pretty promising stuff coming through in the pipeline as well. So, yeah, I think if you look at the big picture, despite the sort of the new enforced ways of remote working that we're all facing, projects are still happening. BSS, OSS projects are still happening. And transformation projects have never been frivolous projects that would be done on a whim. They need a solid business case anyway. And that's no different now than before, you know, the sort of worldwide chaos that we're in now began. So, you know, I think there's still, you know, a lot of exciting stuff coming up over the next, you know, 12, 18, 24 months.
Well, thank you for taking part in this month's Omnizine, Dominic. Where can listeners find out more about Cerillion?
Thank you, Teresa. It's a pleasure as ever chatting to you. Anyone wanting to find out more about Cerillion, then, you know, please do head over to cerillion.com. Lots of case studies, product details and so on there, as well as different methods of contacting us. Whether you want to contact us online or offline, then all of the options are there.
And what would your key takeaway be from all of this?
I think I would go back to a point that we touched on earlier, and that's, you know, the last 3 months have really shown how quickly things can change. And that can be frightening for some people. But it's also demonstrated how quickly businesses can really respond if everyone is aligned in the same direction. And that needs to be something we all continue to do when some semblance of normality returns in the future.
So I'd like to welcome James Saumby, who is the Vice Chair of INCA, to Omnizine. James, welcome to the Omnizine. Can you begin by introducing yourself and INCA, please?
Of course, I'm a professional engineer. I've got 30 years experience in the UK IT and telecoms sector. For the last 15 years, I've been leading Greysky Consulting, specialising in digital infrastructure and strategy. And as you say, I'm also the vice chair of INCA, the Independent Networks Cooperative Association, a member organisation that supports the development of the digital network sector.
Clearly, as we all know, COVID-19 has had a massive impact on the telecoms industry and the business community that we support. It's really important, I think, to say that on the whole, as an industry, we've managed to keep everyone connected and it's worked reasonably well. But we've also learned some very useful lessons, I think. What do you think, James?
Obviously, everyone's talking about COVID-19. It's more or less the only thing that everyone talks about now. And the speed and the impact of that spread has been a massive challenge around the world. So far, the biggest challenge has been, okay, how do we manage the health implication of that? And really, you know, despite all the sort of the odd things that one or two people have suggested, the only really sensible thing that people can say to manage that health impact is go home and stay home. And of course, that means that everyone has gone home and gone onto the internet. There were some worries at the beginning of would the UK sort of internet network cope with that massive change? And well, yes, it has. It's pretty robust, it's reliable, and it's just kept working. Everyone has realized very quickly just how that is important is, both socially to the people, you know, involved, but also to the ongoing economy and even the governance of the country. Everything depends on everyone being able to connect effectively from home. INCA and the rest of the sector have really sort of targeted the maintenance of the network. As I say, the network's pretty reliable, but of course everything does need maintenance. So we've made sure that maintenance people are key workers, and INCA has worked with the government making sure that they got that key worker status right at the start, but also they've had the right guidance in terms of how to do the work with social distancing and work safely, and we've made out to make sure that we've got that out to the sector. So INCA's role has been, in a sense, not just maintaining our own members, but really sort of helping the whole sector to develop that effective and collaborative approach to dealing with these incredibly challenging times.
And as you say there, James, one of the things that's come out of this is that we've realised the importance of the local loop, of the local networks, whether that's broadband or the RAN. You know, it's enabled people to work from home or to run businesses at home. We're in the middle of a programme to upgrade our local networks. And I noticed that, you know, we saw a 50% increase in premises passed last year by fibre. Has COVID-19, do you think, impacted that rollout and our progress towards targets?
Yes, and this is where it all starts to get really complicated. At the moment, we need to maintain the impact on health, and that obviously is the most important thing. But you can already start to see in the news coming through, we're starting to go, okay, what's the economic impact of this? And everyone is starting to worry about that. Clearly, there is going to be a huge impact. It's already uneven because we've got broadly three different categories. We've got those companies who have basically had to just shut up shop, go home and do nothing, and they're all waiting eagerly trying to get back and start work again. There's another group where they've had to shut up shop, but they're now looking at their industry sector in tatters, thinking, well, when is it ever actually going to be able to resume? What's happened here? There's a sort of complete change of the economy for them. And then there's another group where there's been an unprecedented increase in demand for their services, and they've been having to innovate and change to be able to meet that demand within the need to work safely. And so all sort of sectors have had their different challenges, and they're going to change over time. So we're now starting to see, but one thing that is almost common amongst that is everyone needs the internet. So not just, you know, if there's people who are sent home and are just isolated, there's that social aspect of needing to be able to connect, but also pretty much every business continuity plan in the world said go home and work from home. But we've got 3% of people who have no superfast broadband. And the research that we've done in North Wales and Northern Ireland is if you don't have superfast broadband, you've got barely anything at all. There's a sort of a massive drop off. So there's 3% of people who can't contribute. They can't use video conferencing and those tools, because really you need super fast broadband to be able to do that. So they can't use those. Now, is the priority then connect those last 3% first and then move on to the last sort of 10% or thereabouts who don't have full fibre? Or do we stick to where we were before, where we said, oh no, the long-term economic impact is from full fibre, let's press on and do full fibre as fast as possible? It is a really difficult situation, difficult question, because if we focus on those first 3%, then we will slow down the deployment of full fibre to the rest. Had that set out quite clearly before COVID-19 to say, okay, the UK priority is now full fibre, but we have a position that now, because of COVID-19, do we need to rethink that? Is it a time to pause and think perhaps we do need to make sure that everyone's got something first?
5G has become a bit of a dirty word. The towers are now being set alight across the UK. I mean, on the Omnisperience, we view this as being really a symptom of a bigger disease, which is digital disengagement. And it speaks to this digital divide that you're talking about, really. And I think it's really important that we try to solve it, to solve people's fears by educating our customers and so on. You know, what are organisations such as INCA and its members doing to try to sort of bridge this digital divide?
This is a really difficult problem, because it's hard to know what to do about it, isn't it? I think you're right, it's symptomatic of a bigger problem, but I think I'd go further than it than digital disengagement. I'd say it's a disengagement from science, in that, you know, where we've got the President of America suggesting seriously that people might drink disinfectant as a cure for COVID-19, there clearly is a massive problem with our understanding and engagement with science and fact even. So it's a very, very difficult problem to know how to address when you've got people who are that disengaged. I think all we can do is just hope that familiarity allows people to just be, you know, overcome the fears. And until that can happen, honestly, we've talked about it in INCA, and we're just, to be honest, slightly bemused about it, because, of course, we're all scientists, engineers, and people have been in this sector for a while. We understand that there isn't a health implication of 5G, but how can you genuinely make people understand that when they don't want to listen?
But, James, I think even for those who perhaps are not so extreme, there is something of a nervousness, because we're talking about a big step change in technology here, and I think that always engenders a bit of nervousness. And it's important for us to ensure, as you said, that people in rural areas and outlying areas are also part of the digital economy, and they can feel the benefits coming through in order to build that kind of confidence. So our rural networks are actually quite important, I think, in this.
Oh, the rural networks are hugely important. As we've seen in the current position of everyone having to sort of work from home, the rural networks are an important part of all of the economy, because the people who are working in the urban areas and the core cities and whatever, a lot of them live in the rural areas surrounding that. So your business continuity and the whole economic resilience requires that everyone in the community is connected. You can't just sort of focus on the urban areas and see that won't be enough.
And just to focus back on INCA, why is it so important to have an independent sector in the UK? Why don't we just leave it to the big guys? I mean, they all know what they're doing, don't they?
Well, clearly they know what they're doing. I worked for BT for 13 years, and I've just finished doing a project for Openreach in Northern Ireland. So although I'm chair of INCA, I do work with the big guys as well. And so, yes, they know what they're doing, but that doesn't mean that they can do everything. And certainly what we see is there is a role for competition. I'm a big believer in competition, and the presence of retail competition in the internet has been a really important factor in the successful development of the internet in the UK. I think we're getting to the end of what retail competition can achieve. We need to make sure that we maintain that, but I think there is a need now for competition at the infrastructure level. And because Openreach is so big, it's very difficult for a new entrant to compete against that. But the approach of Inca is, if we aggregate, if we all join together, then the independent sector as a whole can be that third competitor. So you've got Openreach, you've got Virgin Media, and you've got the rest of the independent sector. And that approach is starting to pay dividends. We've got the likes of GigaClear and CityFibre, who, although they're not Inca members anymore, they've come through that sort of joining together stage and has allowed them to be, you know, to get a foothold and to make a really serious impact in terms of the network in the UK. And still, by joining together, we are able to provide that extra competition.
So, James, how can our listeners find out more about Inca?
Obviously, we're an online organisation, so on our website there are plenty of resources. There's also access to the programme of webinars that we're going to be running over the next few months. So inca.coop is the place to go, and there you'll find it all.
And in terms of your key message for our listeners, what would you like to tell them?
I think the key thing is that the independent sector is here to stay. It's a positive force in terms of the development of the digital sector, which is important to everybody. And Inca is here to support the development of that sector by allowing everyone to join together.
So I'd like to welcome Ben Toner. Hi Ben, and thanks for joining us on this month's OmniScene. So we're hearing a lot about Wi-Fi 6E at the moment. Is it really such a big deal?
Hi Teresa, thank you for having me. To put it in the words of the Wi-Fi Alliance, 6 gigahertz will pave the way for faster, higher capacity and lower latency Wi-Fi devices and networks. So what's the big deal there? Well, what it really is about, actually, is that 6 gigahertz band is where Wi-Fi 6E lies. And that is an unlicensed band, but it's unprecedented. It's unlicensed and it's wide. It's 1200 megahertz in the US and half of that in other countries. Also, it really doesn't have any congestion. Unlike the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz bands, you can now deploy your Wi-Fi within the 6 gigahertz band in a much higher bandwidth. And higher bandwidth means higher speed. And it also means lower latency. And so really putting that into perspective, there's been some tests that have been carried out by Broadcom and Intel. And by deploying Wi-Fi in 6 gigahertz, they have shown that you can get speeds of 2 gigabits per second and 2 milliseconds of latency. I know you'll probably have some technical listeners. And just to put that into perspective for them, what it really means is prior to 6 gigahertz, in order to deploy Wi-Fi, we were using channels which were 20 megahertz or 40 megahertz wide. And so that gave a certain speed. Now we're going to be able to deploy in 80 megahertz or 160 megahertz channels. So we're talking about quadrupling the amount of spectrum that gets used, quadrupling the speed and the performance. That's it. That's the real big deal about it. It's just going to be blazing fast, really uncontended, giving gigabit speeds. And when you think about people putting fiber in the home, gigabit speeds around the home in a wireless capacity is really what you need.
Ben, let's just be clear here, because I think there's a bit of a confusion in the market. We've heard about Wi-Fi 6 and now we've got Wi-Fi 6E. Can you tell us what the difference is? Is it to do with the spectrum?
Let's roll back just a bit. So Wi-Fi 6 is a brand name. As you might know and you might be aware, the Wi-Fi standards were prefixed by 802.11 previously. And Wi-Fi 6 is not different. It's 802.11ax. And just to come back to that, it was the standard was released in 2019. And it added a whole raft of improvements and features on top of previous versions of Wi-Fi to make sure that each connected device could perform an optimal level. So Wi-Fi 6E means 6 extended, and all it really is the extension of Wi-Fi 6 into the 6 gigahertz band. And I'll just recap that prior to this, and as it stands today, in fact, we've been able to deploy Wi-Fi in 2.4 gigahertz, where the original deployments were. Then we moved into 5 gigahertz. And now we'll be able to move into 6 gigahertz, which is really wide. a very, very important point there is that the 6 gigahertz band will not allow anything prior to the Wi-Fi 6 or 802.11ax standard to be deployed within it. So Wi-Fi 6 is going to be in this band, and it's going to be able to run all by itself without any need to support legacy. And supporting legacy has been a bit of an impediment to standards in the past. And coming back a little bit to what Wi-Fi 6 is all about, there are a couple of major innovations within there, which are actually not too dissimilar to other cellular standards. And I'll just bring a few of them out for the listeners. OFDMA, which is a feature that enables high density allocation to different devices. So each device can have just the right resource for what it needs. There's multi-user MIMO, which allows multiple antennas to create spatial diversity and talk to multiple devices at the same time. There's target wake time, which allows for power saving in low power devices, letting them go to sleep and wake at just the right moment. Taking all of those features and then putting it into the 6 gigahertz where there's no interference and wider channels and just letting it run super fast is why Wi-Fi 6E is so exciting. And that's the difference between Wi-Fi 6 and Wi-Fi 6E. It's probably just worth noting that in the 6 gigahertz band, future standards will be able to deploy there, but not prior standards.
Okay, so you're kind of making me into a believer here, but I have to say, I have to play the devil's advocate. You know, we've got pretty mature 4G out there in the market. We've got 5G. Everyone's super excited about that. Does Wi-Fi have a future? Is it a technology with a future, or is it a technology that's really had its day? Is this an either-or technology, either cellular or Wi-Fi, or do you see these two things mashing up some kind of convergence scenario?
Okay, so that's a great question, Anne. But I'm a believer that they work together. So I'll tell you why. So there are cases for either of them, okay? And let's say, for instance, in the home, Wi-Fi has a very, very strong position, okay? So we all use Wi-Fi in our home. We've got many devices which are Wi-Fi only. I can list a few. Tablets, smart speakers, TVs, PCs, various things to do with home automation, like a security camera or even your doorbell. All of these things are Wi-Fi only. And so Wi-Fi can't go away. And it's in fact the very nature that some of those are very high bandwidth, TV needing to stream 4K resolution media, versus something else like a smart speaker, which is doing something at quite narrow bandwidth, or something else within home automation, which doesn't really need high capacity. And actually, that's where Wi-Fi 6 really comes in and lets you use the high capacity and the low capacity simultaneously without them interfering. That is really a case for Wi-Fi in the home. And even more generally indoors, you're not going to sort of be able to use the macro cell 4G, 5G indoors without repeating it somehow. So the very nature of the higher frequencies that are used mean it won't penetrate particularly well, especially in multi-dwelling units or deep indoors in hospitals or schools and so on. So you'll need to do something in there. We really haven't seen a great uptake in internal small cells at the consumer level, although it's been tried in the past. You might remember the Vodafone Sure Signal and so on. Those things are hard to come by. It's not that they're not there. It's just that it's been difficult. I should say that the 6 gigahertz band itself is an unlicensed band, and any unlicensed technology can go into it as long as it follows the general rules. We are very likely to see an unlicensed version of 5G come about and be developed, and whether it takes off or not will come down to many things. But for me, it's hard to see that the price point of 5G coming down to a point where it will be in everything, you know, including your Alexa speaker and your Google Home or your doorbell. I don't think that will happen anytime soon to remove Wi-Fi from the picture of the general indoor home enterprise use case. Flip side, looking at 4G, 5G, why they're out there? Well, they're out there because they've got a great perspective in terms of giving a secure mobile experience. Okay, so your SIM card is very secure by its nature, and the mobility of 4G and 5G is something that has been really built in. So we are used to being able to walk around, whereas we all know that Wi-Fi is hard to move between. It's clunky at best. But you asked the question whether or not there may be some level of convergence out there? And the answer is very much yes, actually. I don't know how many people know this, but Apple devices already do some of that. They already converge different Wi-Fi and cellular together using something, to get a little bit technical for a second, called multipath TCP. And it's used in Siri, it's used in Maps, and it's used in Apple Music. And if you try and use one of those particular features, the phone will actually try and use Wi-Fi and cellular at the same time and make a decision, depending on what the application is, which is better for that location. Now, with technologies like that, as you can imagine, in certain hotspot areas where people really want to use a lot of mobile bandwidth, let's say a busy shopping mall in the center of London, very, very dense, lots of devices connecting, an operator has to put in a lot of equipment, they could put in Wi-Fi in that space, because devices which operate multipath in that way will decide whether to use Wi-Fi or cellular using their technology and their algorithms and figure out what's right. Also, it has another benefit. All of a sudden, in those dense areas, by putting in Wi-Fi, you get the ability to bring all your Wi-Fi only devices. So you go to a restaurant, kids have got tablets, they're Wi-Fi only as they stand today, most of them, that you can use them. So really, I think they're not either or. They will coexist. 5G will have its place out in the mobility, Wi-Fi internally, indoors. And then where in super dense locations where you need to put both of them, you really can do that because the technologies are coming through the works. 3GPP are looking at it to be able to bring them through and let you use both together.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ben. I think it's a horses for courses sort of situation here, where both have inherently interesting characteristics for specific use cases. And there are some where, you know, you probably need a bit of both. But when we think about that kind of innovation with regards to Wi-Fi, what sort of use cases do you think are going to be particularly compelling in the nearish future? And what are people going to be prepared to pay for in terms of Wi-Fi? You know, where can a service provider see some revenue streams coming from, do you think?
Okay, so I think one of the big innovations that will come about from Wi-Fi 6E is going to be underpinned by the fact that there's so much bandwidth. And I recently listened to a conversation where CommScope put forward an example of a very wide bandwidth backbone within an indoor environment like a home. So you might have in what will might become the next version, Wi-Fi 7, a 320 megahertz channel bandwidth, taking a gigabit fiber input, creating a big long backbone through a home, and then having units in around that home or that environment. Maybe you could even imagine a hospital or a school with some kind of invisible fiber, which is your wide bandwidth Wi-Fi, going down through it, and then devices hanging off that, wirelessly in this case, then providing gigabit services in more localized areas, so that when one classroom or an operating theater, or in fact, you know, a bedroom in an attic of a home wants to watch a 4K stream, that service is absolutely delivered without any difficulty to that location. And in fact, you then got, because you've got this very high bandwidth, low latency stream throughout the environment that you're in, you can actually talk between different areas. You could imagine an operating theatre with cameras and another part of the hospital being able to access a live stream of what's going on in there without really any disruption at all, and no need to put in cables which are, you know, got hygiene factor to them or some kind of issue with installation as you build these hospitals and so on. So I think the use cases in really getting that gigabit service around buildings is going to be one that I'm looking forward to seeing. And if you're somebody who is thinking of putting in something towards gigabit fiber in the future, so in the US we see upwards of 500 megabits per second, and in the UK there's services out there who are going to deploy at 1 gigabit per second, you know, you're paying for that, so why not get it everywhere? You asked a little bit about cost, and it really is a bit of a sore point that in order to put in multi-access point units into homes today, you have to go out there and you usually buy a trio of units, right? A base unit plus two extenders. And that kind of cost is around £400. It really is quite a lot. There is an opportunity for service providers just to think a little bit about the business model and say, well, maybe they can move away from giving you one unit in your home to a whole home system without the consumer needing to pay for those extra units. But then saying, well, now because you've got gigabit in every room or every location, there's more consumption of service which could be monetized in return to offset that cost.
Yeah, I'm liking the thinking there. I think, you know, moving to smart home solutions and maybe including things like some of the IoT devices that and management of that, a solution around that, I think is a very interesting business model. Because I don't know about you, Ben, but, you know, my smart objects are going to break and I don't really know how to fix them. So I'd really like someone to do that for me and to keep the whole thing rocking and rolling. So when can we expect all of this to happen, Ben? You know, we're all excited now. What are the dependencies here? When is this going to start hitting the road?
Okay, so to really enable all of this, there's a couple of things that need to come together. Wi-Fi 6E needs the 6 gigahertz spectrum becoming available for use for unlicensed units. And of course, the big landmark decision that just happened at the end of last month was that the FCC have released the full 1200 megahertz of 6 gigahertz band in the US, which is absolutely phenomenal. It's huge. It allows so much Wi-Fi to be deployed. It will be available for use from other wireless services like unlicensed 5G or 4G, but that's not there yet. So for now, this spectrum is going to be Wi-Fi based. So following on from the FCC, we need spectrum to become available in other nations. So the UK are actually mid-consultation as we speak. The European Commission has been in consultation, is expected to make a decision in January next year. So we could see now devices becoming available in the US later this year and in the EU and the UK sort of around mid-2021. We think that an event like Mobile World Congress around March next year will be about the right time to see devices being publicized and become available soon after that on the market. Asia Pacific is a little behind in terms of timeline, so we think we'll see decisions on the spectrum there for 2022-ish. From the enterprise point of view, though, what we think we'll see is about 30% or more penetration of Wi-Fi 6E devices round about the close of 2022. So decisions being made in 2021, being actioned, maybe hitting the 2022 budgets at that point in time, and then effectively the fit out happening in that timescale. It is important, just as we're talking about timelines, to kind of bring one point to light, and that is the spectrum has been licensed in a couple of ways. One is for low power use indoors. And then for outdoor use, where you expect to need higher power, it is dependent on an automated frequency coordination system, because there are systems in the 6 gigahertz bands that can't be interfered with. That automated frequency coordination, called AFC, is not quite ready or certified yet. And that won't be certified till 2021. So that's going to push a little bit of the outdoor equipment deployment out towards more like 2022.
And in summary, Ben, what's your key advice to service providers around Wi-Fi 6E? What should they be thinking about and what should they be doing?
Wi-Fi 6 itself is a revolution in terms of its features and technology, and 6E is allowing it to move into the 6 gigahertz band without contention. So all of a sudden, what we're seeing is Wi-Fi is becoming closer to licensed cellular in terms of its reliability and in terms of how much a service provider can depend on it. From the home side of things, my ask of service providers would be to see more whole home systems becoming bundled. Just as a technical point, 6 gigahertz, it's a high frequency, so it won't actually travel quite as far. So to fill out larger homes or homes with lots of walls and non-direct line of sight, we'll need whole home systems. And today, somebody has to pay a little bit extra for them. So I'd like to see that becoming more of a standard that we we go with maybe CommScope's idea of putting in these backbones with gigabit rooms, I'd like to see service providers offering that as standard and actually offsetting the cost of that with better services. Or, you know, I'd rather pay the money as a monthly subscription to get, you know, all the latest sports and movies rather than buying equipment which becomes obsolete. So getting into a subscription where my equipment gets updated regularly. From service providers looking to densify outside of the home, I really think looking towards the 5G specifications on convergence, looking at what Apple have done, and considering the quality of Wi-Fi 6E, maybe going down that route, starting to test now about how to use Wi-Fi, especially in the 6 gigahertz band, together with cellular in a converged way where it's frictionless and you can move between one and the other and the user doesn't even notice. I'd like to see that happening. I think service providers should really be testing those standards and those technologies now.
Hello, I'm Georgina Elrington, and today I'm going to be finding out about a new sector opportunity, and it's called the nano business sector. The nano business sector sits under the micro business part of the S in SME, and Omnisperience forecasts that the nano business community will be generating more than $1 trillion of revenue worldwide by 2025. Now, when faced with figures like that, there's a clear message for the service providers that if they ignore this market or perhaps consider it as too small to bother with, they'll miss out on new revenue streams. I'm here with Omnisperience's chief analyst, Teresa Cottam, to find out more. Hello, Teresa. Would you like to introduce yourself to us, please?
Hi, George. Yes, thank you for having me. My name's Teresa Cottam. I'm the chief analyst at Omnisperience. Omnisperience covers the business-to-business telecoms market as well as all the technology that supports business customers. And we cover everything from wholesale, large enterprise, SME, down to the micro business and now nano business sectors. I've been an analyst for, well, quite a long time, and I'm a judge for the GSMA Glomo Awards and for the UK Cloud Awards. And my areas of expertise, I guess, are really the commercial layer. So things like billing, charging, payments, bundling, the commercial strategies, and also into things like customer experience and customer service.
And perhaps the best place to start this chat is by telling me what a nano business actually is.
Okay, so we have defined a nano business as being a business that employs less than one full-time worker. And it encompasses a whole range of businesses that sell goods, that sell creativity, services, labour, or even influence, as well as those that allow the commercial sharing of something that the person already owns. And it's very important to emphasise that it is a business, so it's not something, an activity that you're doing as a hobby. It could be a hobby that you have monetized, but there has to be a commercial element to it, George.
And what was it about the nano business opportunity that got your attention?
Omnisperience perceives that the emergence of the nano business is really a fundamental change in the business market. So traditionally, we have looked at the business market as comprising very large enterprises down into the SME sector. And we came up with this concept of a micro business, which are businesses with less than 10 employees. And they're the most common kind of business that we have in most economies. So in the UK, for example, 97% of the businesses that we have in the UK are actually micro businesses. But even that definition doesn't take account of a new phenomenon that started happening recently, where more and more people are starting to work in part-time businesses or monetized hobbies, or they're starting to, you know, rent out things that they own and make money out of that, or they are micro retailers who are selling things on platforms such as Amazon and eBay. And all of these things, when you put them together, it's actually a huge economy and one that a lot of people are engaging in, and one that, you know, they're making a lot of money out of them. As an aggregate, it's a big opportunity for service providers, we believe. Sometimes service providers are not very good at selling to smaller businesses, and they might ask, well, you know, what's the point? You know, there isn't enough revenue there. But if we turn that around a little bit and we said to them, But what would you do to raise the ARPU of your customers by £10 or £20 a month? And the answer is they do quite a lot. Another question might be, what would you do to reduce your churn rates? And the answer is quite a lot to that as well. And of course, the secret to reducing churn is to better meet the needs of the customers that you have. So if your customers have all these side gigs going on, if they're making money by working from home, they're involved in the nano business economy, and you're not actually meeting their needs, then you're increasing the risk that you're going to lose those customers to a rival who will meet their needs better. And I think there's another part to this as well, which is that bigger businesses want to buy in the services of nano businesses. So they represent a huge pool of labour and of expertise and services that bigger businesses now want to consume. So if you're in the business of selling to those enterprises, then you really want to understand how they're working with nano businesses and how you can support that as well, because I think that's a big opportunity. And it's not just connectivity, it's the ability to supply technologies such as security software, collaborative software, data services, and so on and so forth.
But is it a whole new concept, Teresa? Africa is an example that's been conducting a lot of small business on a smartphone for years.
I think you're right, George. In some ways, this isn't a new concept as such. But it's never had a name for it. It's something that, you know, in some ways has always been there. People have always had little side businesses that they run. What is new is that we now have digital platforms that underpin this nano business economy. And what they do is they help bring the work and the worker together and match them. And that is something that's new. The component parts of this economy are also concepts that we've been talking about for a while. So, for example, we have micro retailing, like on Amazon or on eBay. We have the gig economy, and there's a lot being written about that. The sharing economy. So that's things like, you know, whether you're sharing your house, you're reselling space in your house or your car or what have you. The creative economy. So making things and putting it on YouTube and making money out of that. And the influencer economy, which is very closely related. So people make money now just by, you know, being seen as being influential on platforms like Instagram. And all of these bits are component parts of the nano business economy. But by seeing them as parts of a whole thing, what you start to realize is that there are these needs that people have to run these side businesses, which are addressable by service providers. And I think it's going to play out very differently according to the sector of the nano business economy that you are operating in, and also according to the geographical market that you're operating in as well.
So how can the service providers make money out of the nano business sector?
Well, as I said, George, they traditionally they're not very good at addressing smaller businesses. They find it very difficult to address that market well. And in fact, they may have even had a channel strategy and handed off, you know, dealing with smaller businesses to partners rather than actually trying to sell to them directly. But all of that is changing. They need the margin and the business that these customers represent. So clearly, if they're trying to sell to very tiny businesses, whether that's micro businesses or nano businesses, they need to think about this and sell to these people very differently. You need a lot of automation in there. You need to actually give a lot of control to the business itself. So this is going to mean that you need things like self-service, self-bundling and self-configuration. One of the problems that we've had in the past is that the services and the products that you are allowed to buy as a customer are actually determined by internal decisions within the service provider. So may have deemed that you're a prepaid customer, so you're only allowed to have a subset of services, or you're a postpaid customer, so you get a different set of services. Or they may have decided you're a consumer, so you can have these services, but not those services, and vice versa. If you're a business customer, then you're treated differently and you're served differently. And the trouble with that is it's a hard line between different customer types, reinforced by the IT stacks that support the different divisions of a service provider. And these hard lines are blurring, and they're no longer as hard or as applicable as they were in the past. A lot of the opportunities are now coming from the gaps. And it's really important that the service provider has a more flexible approach to its customers. You should never be in a situation where you are telling a customer, no, you can't buy something from us. Always be in the position of saying, of course you can buy that. Having recognised that, because this is a volume market, you do have to approach it in a way that, as I said, is very automated and far more like selling to consumers than selling to, for example, large enterprise customers. So to make it profitable, you need to have that self-service element and you need to be able to automate a lot of this offering and package up what you're offering them into configurable packages, yes, but not bespoke packages. So simple solutions that are aimed at, you know, the activity that they're undertaking that they can tweak a little bit rather than, you know, assembling something specifically for that business from scratch.
And can you tell me a bit more about how you arrived at the forecast of this nano business sector accounting for a $1 trillion global revenue?
Yes, in fact, we think that that is a big underestimate of the potential of this market. And because this is a green paper that we've just produced, we're still in the discussion stage and we're actually refining our forecasts at the moment and they will be ready for when the full white paper comes out. But if you just look at the value currently of, you know, the component obvious parts of this market, so, you know, the gig economy and the sharing economy, et cetera, you realise that when you add those bits together, it's around, you know, $1 trillion. I think if we look at this in more detail and more holistically, what we'll realise is it's far more than $1 trillion and it's growing quite rapidly as well. I think that the opportunity for service providers is at the moment, you know, a sort of proportion of that. But we have to remember that these are businesses that are highly dependent on ICT. So even if you look at this as, is it new spend or is it influencing existing spend? This market is extremely influential. People will change their service provider if their needs are not met. So even from a defensive play, I think it's really important that you think about this opportunity and get it right.
Thanks, Teresa. And where can people find out more about this?
So we have a free green paper, George, that they can download from our website. A green paper is a discussion paper. It's our first thoughts on this market. And you can get that from our website at omnisperience.com. We also have a little bit of an explanation in our pod scene, in our February 2020 pod scene, which you can listen to, which is also free for you to stream from our website.
And do you have a final top tip for service providers looking at the nano business sector?
So my key advice is, firstly, be aware of it. Think about this as a sector in its own right. And think about how you're actually segmenting your customer base, because I can guarantee you're missing a lot of opportunity just because you're the way you're actually looking at your customers and your customer needs. At the end of the day, this, like so many other opportunities in the market, is predicated on you really understanding your customer and those customers' needs. And if you do that, I think you can find whole new revenue streams that at the moment you're overlooking or that you're giving away to other businesses out there and which you could be retaining for yourself. And you're also going to build a lot of loyalty with the customers that you already have if you better meet their needs.